This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Angry at the Right Things. This is Bronwyn and
Katie.
And we are excited today to be here. I am thankful for Katie because she's somewhat of a contortionist. You don't see our setup, but she has to kind of sit on this big pillow in an awkward way because we're not really good with like videoing and computers and all that. So thank you, Katie.
Oh, you're welcome.
So today we are going to talk about rupture and repair. And I'm excited to share another self reflection of myself and my journey with you guys that is very intimate and very vulnerable with you today.
All right.
So this is called Rupture and Repair. So the first time I betrayed Edie was the day she was born. And boy, was she angry. Believe it or not, I did almost everything right. You see, that was my idealistic phase of life, which only encompassed the first 40 years. I was a young 32, or was it 33, since she was born on my birthday. And I had planned to have the ideal birth to welcome my ideal baby. Edie was going to be my one and only child, because that way I had a higher likelihood of doing everything right. So here I was in the midst of my perfect birth in my cozy home with the two midwives coaching me. Everything was going very well, as it should. I was laboring at a good pace, and the senior midwife was impressed. I was impressed too, because here I was fully dilated just 10 hours after labor began. And of course, I was drug-free because I was strong. And I could do this without meds, and I was in my own home. What an empowered woman I was. Now I was being told that it's time to push. So I push, and now I'm feeling the pain. It feels like my pelvis will split in two if I continue to push, in fact. The midwife doesn't seem to care, and she is now coaching me louder. Push! But I can't, because it will kill me. I would tell her this if I could speak, but the pain rules out that option. She leads me into the bathroom and has me sit down on the toilet seat in order to encourage my body to do what I am unwilling to do. And it doesn't work because I am holding back. She then leads me into the warm kiddie pool and has me get down on my hands and knees. Push, she yells, but I don't. I can't articulate an excuse. She's now telling me the reason it hurts so bad is because Edie's forehead is pressed up against my pelvis, my pelvic bone, and that I have to push past the pain. All I can think is, who is Edie? There's just me, and I am going to die. Finally, she tells me that the only way that the pain will stop is if I push the baby out. This logic hits me on the side of my head like a brick. If I push the baby out, there will be no more pain. Brilliant. She has me position myself on my bed on my hands and knees and tells me to growl low from my diaphragm. I push as if my life depends on it, because I think it actually does. Edie gets pushed into the world, and boy, is she angry. Her right eye is bruised from being shoved against my pelvic bone for about an hour. And when she comes out, somehow she knows I'm to blame, because she looks me right in the eyes and yells at me. I think, how does she know it's me? There are two other women in this room. The midwife, who has boasted facilitating over 600 births at this juncture, says out loud, "I have never seen such an angry baby." 20 years later, I realize in retrospect that I betrayed Edie that day. I was in pain, and it never occurred to me that she was too, for the very same reason. It never occurred to me that my refusal to push past the pain caused her to experience so much pain. I chose my comfort over hers, and it hurt her. What a way to ruin a birthday, hers and mine. Apparently, she forgave me, and we recovered this time. The second time I betrayed Edie, she was 5. Just like the first time, I had no idea I was hurting her. And just like the first time, I was suffering myself so much, I forgot all about her. The second time wasn't physical, and there was no tangible evidence of my failure, which made it that much harder for me to see. All I knew is I was depressed, in a pit of despair I did not predict or even imagine possible. You see, we'd relocated to another city, and I knew no one, and I felt so alone, and even my husband seemed a million miles away. For anyone who's experienced major depression, it's like you've become a black hole and you're swallowed up by yourself. That was me. It never occurred to me for a minute that Edie had her own set of feelings about our move, about losing all her friends, or her dog, who was like her older sibling. I wouldn't know, because it's like I forgot all about her. Nor did I realize what it'd feel like to be a 5-year-old who is suddenly grieving a mom who's still alive, but only in body. A mom who no longer makes eye contact, who no longer smiles or laughs. A mom who's lost inside herself. It never occurred to me that what Edie was experiencing felt like rejection from me. All I knew was my experience of the pain, and subsequently that also consisted of being around a daughter who appeared to suddenly hate me. On top of the depression, it was too much now to lose what felt like my daughter's love. I felt even more alone. It was a downward spiral. Over the next year, I was able to make some necessary changes to pull out of the severity of my depression, but not the rejection I was experiencing daily from Edie. That continued for the next 14 years. For the majority of those years, I felt like her enemy, and I had no idea why. For the next 14 years, we would fight like hell, and I would reveal a side of myself I never knew existed. Eerily, this side of me was like a reincarnation of my mother when she was most monster-like. Something I swore I would never do. I did. When I finally figured out how to be a good therapist, I became a learner, and I saw how much betrayal is at the root of all of our unbecoming behavior and mental illness. Slowly, as I started connecting the dots, I realized how many children seem to change out of nowhere when they felt betrayed by their parent. A biggie is when a younger sibling is born, but it could be anything, and usually it's unintentional, and the parent has no freaking idea. You see, children, just like adults, are blind to themselves, and they're not able to name what they're experiencing. They're not able to say things like, "Mom, you used to be so interested in me, and I came to expect that, and it's gone suddenly, and it feels like abandonment." Nor can children realize that their experience of rejection is a mom problem, not a them problem. So they internalize the perceived rejection believing implicitly that something is inherently wrong with them, which we call shame. So when the pieces started coming together for me as a therapist, I was able to piece together what the hell had happened 14 years earlier. I was able to see how and where my perfect mothering ambition had gone south. I wrote Edie an apology, and I titled it Dear 5-Year-Old Edie. I owned my fail, and I was also able to finally tell her the rejection she'd experienced was 100% a me problem, not a her problem. Suddenly, the animosity melted away, as did her 14-year-old experience of chronic head and stomach aches and her anxiety. It all went away. This reinforced my belief that our bodies hold on to anger, and the suppressed anger from betrayal causes anxiety, depression, and physical ailments. As for my relationship with Edie, it's back. We have been reunited, and it's all the sweeter now. You see, we therapists talk about something called rupture and repair. We teach that all relationships experience some kind of rupture sooner or later, and what matters isn't trying to avoid the rupture, but instead having a really good repair. Here's the crazy part. A good repair actually makes for a stronger relationship than one that has never experienced a rupture. Just like muscle tissue grows stronger after it experiences what we term micro tears, or scar tissue is stronger than that pre-existing skin, a relationship becomes trustworthy, tried, and true when there's been the level of vulnerability that occurs from an honest admission of wrongdoing, an apology, and a demonstrated commitment to do better. Research on relationships shows that attachment grows stronger after a rupture, but only after a good repair. In fact, evidence demonstrates that after a good repair, there is an increased level of trust as well as vulnerability in that relationship. This type of relationship is deemed safe because both parties now know that a mistake doesn't mean the end of a relationship, and they feel free to let down their guard in each other's presence. In other words, the relationship is one in which they feel free to be human versus a fear of feeling shamed or abandoned. This is the type of relationship in which we can grow, because everyone knows that growth entails making lots of mistakes. This is what we can model for our children, and it's powerful. This is also the environment we can create for them so they too can take the risk to grow. I'm no longer an idealist, but a realist, and I am committed to reality at all costs. Reality can be ugly, to be sure, and seeing myself clearly is not easy or convenient. But I've learned the hard way what it costs to keep my eyes closed and how ignorance and denial are life-threatening. I've come too far to be dead inside for another moment. Reality is messy and ugly at times, but it's the only path to life, thriving and flourishing. And I have no regrets.
Wow. That's quite the oh, what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah.
That's a big share.
Is it like a expose? What do they call that? Expose? Yeah. Like when someone writes about themselves.
Yeah.
An expose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Memoir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Thank you. Well, Katie, you said that you remember me in my idealistic days.
I do. And that was, I've known you almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And when I first met you, you were definitely the most idealistic person I'd ever met. And there's a lot to admire in idealism and a lot of passion in it.
Definitely that.
But I've also seen how you've changed, and it's been fascinating to watch and learn from you and all you've learned becoming the therapist that you are now. And like you said, like, reality at all costs. And I think being I was thinking about it, and I think being idealistic can sometimes mean not really seeing reality.
Yeah.
Not really living in reality, and hiding from from painful things.
Yeah, it's a type of denial.
Yeah.
Idealism is actually a type of denial, which is so fascinating that I never saw that until today. You brought that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, and it's like a form of self-deception.
Yeah. Yeah.
And self-deception is so much of what gets us into trouble with our relationships.
Yeah.
With each other and with ourselves.
Yeah.
And like you said, how you didn't see how you were hurting Edie.
Yeah.
And she probably didn't see it either, but she felt it. She knew it deep inside.
Yes. And that's what's so crazy, because we were talking about betrayal.
Yes.
And, you know, we think of betrayal as, well, you told me you would do this and you didn't.
Right.
But I didn't tell Edie I would never get depressed and like ignore her. So betrayal isn't just what is obvious and explicit. Betrayal, like, even though she didn't know, oh, I'm feeling betrayed by my mother, a part of her did know.
Right.
And so isn't it interesting that we humans have these expectations on our parents and our spouses and on people closest to us? We don't know they're there, but they are. And when that person, you know, when it feels like they've abandoned us or let us down, even though they don't know they're doing it, even though we don't know cognitively, a part of us is like, it knows. It knows, and we feel the betrayal, and that's when we get depressed or anxious.
And we don't. Like we tell our small children, use your words. We don't use our words. We don't always use them very well, right?
Yeah.
Like we might use them unkindly, make sarcastic remarks, passive aggressive retorts, you know, as a way of showing our pain instead of just being honest and vulnerable and saying, you did this and I feel hurt by that.
Yeah.
If we did that more often, we could have a more honest relationship, and the other person would know how you felt and have the opportunity to apologize and make amends. And instead, anger and resentment build and lead to ever worsening disconnection.
Yeah, because in this case, this is so interesting actually now that I'm thinking about it. In this case, so Edie felt abandoned by me or rejected, because those two are the same thing. Feeling rejected and abandoned is one and the same. She felt abandoned by me. She felt rejected by me. She rejected me back.
Right.
For the next 14
mechanism.
For the next 14 years. Her rejection of me back made me more depressed. So it was like this spiral.
Oh, yeah.
And angry. And simultaneously, my depression that I fell in was because we had moved and I felt so alone, but Steve was part of making me feel so alone. I felt betrayed by him, but I didn't know I was feeling betrayed by him.
Right.
I didn't know that he didn't know I was feeling betrayed by him. That was at the root of my own depression, was him feeling a million miles away when I needed him the most, but I was not cognizant of any of this. So it's like, I'm betrayed by him. I'm betraying Edie. She's betraying me back. It was like a rejection party.
Like
everyone's
insult
like.
Insult to injury, ping ponging back and forth on everyone.
Oh my God.
Right?
Yeah. So crazy.
Yeah.
And we're all in so much pain. And we're like, the three of us are family, but we feel so far away from each other.
Right.
So painful.
Disconnected.
So disconnected. It was a shit show, guys. Okay. So I want to talk more about – so my segue here is – so Edie's 14-year experience with her anxiety, her head and stomach aches for 14 years, which are over now since I apologized and since I made good with her, miraculously, they have vanished. So that's how powerful this is. That's not – kudos to me. That's just, I'm just want to illustrate how powerful right. it is that her 14 years of suppressed anger in her body took that level of toll on her for 14 years. And the minute our repair is good, which took a while, but the minute that is healed and resolved, she no longer has the same, anywhere near the same level of anxiety, and her headaches and stomach aches are a thing of the past.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
It's like a profound example of what they call somatic experiencing. Somatic
experiencing,
right?
Yes. Like, or somatic pathology. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was the case with her. Now, that was her suppressed anger in her body doing that for 14 years. Now I want to segue to my husband, Steve. He had a recent bout of depression that lasted about 36 hours that I want to talk about that was also stemming from his suppressed anger in his body that he was also not aware of. I became aware of it, and it was at me, of course. So let's talk about that. While I'm exposing myself, I'm being a what's it called? People who expose themselves. We call them
oh God.
There's like the ones who watch, and there's the one anyway,
right?
Exhibitionist.
Yes,
I'm emotionally exhibitioning myself today. That's as far as it's gonna get. So Steve, okay, this happened last Thursday. Okay, so he wakes up Thursday morning, comes downstairs, and he looks at me and he's like, "It was hard to get up this morning." And I'm like, "Are you sick?" He goes, "I'm depressed." Okay, for my husband to be able to say that.
And note, this is out of character for Steve.
Out of character.
Yeah.
For him to, it must be pretty depressing if he actually notices he's depressed. So he says that. And I'm like, what? You just woke up depressed? Like yesterday you were fine. And I'm like brainstorming. We're brainstorming. What could it be? Could it be this? Could it be this? Could it be this? No, no, no. Anyway, finally. Later that day, I'm thinking, wait, Edie came over last night because she was coming over every Wednesday night for dinner because she doesn't live with us anymore. So Edie came over last night, Wednesday night. Okay, what happened? So I'm thinking, you know, I talked to Steve about it. So what had happened was, first of all, I was upstairs working. She came a couple hours before I came downstairs. So she had just sat with Steve on the couch. He was working, but he also tried to talk to her and asked her about her life and had good questions. And she refused to answer them like she tends to do often with me and with him. And she just sat there and they just kind of sat in silence for like a couple hours, which is like kind of normal. But then when I was done working, I come downstairs, we're in the kitchen. And she just starts talking and talking and talking about all these things. And, you know, Steve's kind of feeling like, what am I, chopped liver, right? Because you're talking to your mom. You didn't talk to me for the 2 hours. We sat silently by each other. So that was part A. And, you know, to be honest, I am loving my new position as the favored parent because, as y'all now know, I was the unfavored parent by far for 14 years. Mm-hmm. So I was loving being the favored parent. So I was reveling in it. And so we sit down for dinner and I'm still like feeling like the favored parent, loving it. Steve asks Edie a really good question. And this is where my monster part comes out. And I go, Steve, that's not a very attuning question. So Bronwyn's now feeling like this competition. She doesn't want to share the favored parent status with her husband. So she like takes the one thing she's really good at as a therapist is attunement. The one thing Steve is really insecure about is attunement. And she's like, yeah, I'm just going to squish you like a bug right here. Enjoy. And so anyway, Edie's like, Mom, that's horrible. And then Steve's like, yeah. And I go, oh, yeah, sorry. Okay, so that was it. So when I realize all of this and it occurs to me how ugly I was, so I was actually getting out of the shower. I remember Friday morning. So remember, this is like a 36-hour depression episode. So I'm getting out of the shower Friday morning. I'm like, I am such a monster. Oh, so I go downstairs and I go, I know why you're depressed. It's suppressed anger at me because I said this ugly, cruel thing. When you were at your weakest, I kicked you when you were down. And he looks at me, goes, yeah. And I go, I'm so, so sorry. He's like, okay. So I go back upstairs. I come downstairs an hour later and he is back to normal. Depression over.
Yeah.
So suppressed anger can cause a 14-year-long anxiety, chronic anxiety episode, or a 36-hour short depressive episode. Suppressed anger is at the root of mental illness. That's been my own experience as well, which I've shared on other episodes.
Yes.
Okay. I also want to just talk about and do some like psychoed on what happened with me and Edie and Steve. So we call this triangulation. Mm. We therapists refer to that as triangulation, and it happens all the time, and it is ugly in general. So there's three people, and when there's three people, there's often what we call these unconscious alliances that we want to form. And I am liking this little alliance between me and Edie, and I'm protecting it. I'm protecting it. I don't want to let Steve in, right? So that was that. Now, sometimes this happens where Steve and Edie will make fun of Mom. And it's usually pretty funny and it doesn't last long. But if that were to go on, that would be like a serious triangulation. And I would not be okay with that. Usually they're just short and they're funny. So that's triangulation. Triangulation, again, ascribes to what we talked about on a previous podcast as looking at power. But remember, power, attention is power, or approval is power. As a zero-sum game. I don't want to share it. I want to hoard the attention. I want to be an attention hoard. I want the favor. I want to not share the favoritism. I want to be the favorite. So that's that zero-sum game, instead of seeing it as like, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if Edie felt so comfortable with both of us and we were both the favorite parents?
Right.
Which is actually very possible. So we can all be ugly, and that would include me. Yeah. Okay. So that's what I wanted to say about that. Okay. More exposition of myself. I consider myself a recovering, not borderline personality disorder, but I have borderline personality features. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about the difference, because I have a lot of clients. Again, I've said this before, but they'll say, when I talk about borderline personality disorder, they'll say, do I have borderline? And they identify, because if I talk about borderlines as averse, they have an aversion to rejection or feeling perceived rejection. And we all hate that. We all humans hate real or perceived rejection. So that is endemic to humanity. But some of us show it in different ways. So I am more on the borderline spectrum. I have borderline features. And so I'm going to share some more about that. So I had my best friend for many, many years. She died of pancreatic cancer about a decade ago. Her name was Julie. And she was my bestie, one of my two besties growing up. And when we were in college, she went down to Chile, the country of Chile, for a while. She had kind of like for an exchange student guy that she befriended, and she and our mutual friend Jen went down there for like 3 weeks. And I was really excited to see her when she came back, and we were talking on the phone when she came back. So this is before we had cell phones and all that. And she was telling me about it. Well, turns out she'd kind of fallen in love with the guy that she had hosted as kind of an exchange student. They had never had a romantic relationship until she went down to visit him for the 3 weeks. And so she was just like all like crazy over the moon about her time in Chile. Like she wasn't very objective about it. And so she was telling me about it. And the thing she said that triggered me was she said, I didn't want to come back. And it was because of the guy. And I'm not sure if I knew that at the time, but it didn't matter because when I heard that, I hung up on Julie.
Whoa.
So here I am like 20 years old. She went to Chile for the first time ever, had this great time. And when I heard, I didn't want to come back, I hang up on her.
Right. Like you were like, you love Chile and this guy more than you love me.
Right? Yeah. I think that literally like, hearing her say, I didn't want to come back, I was like, you want to abandon me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I hung up, which is very borderline thing to do. So I want to just share that here's the difference, though, between me and a true borderline even then. So if a therapist had made a house call right after I hung up with Julie, and if that therapist had said, Bronwyn, you were triggered by what felt like abandonment when she said, I didn't want to come back, you overreacted because that was a trigger, and triggers aren't rational, and we act or react in ways that are disproportionate to the present. It's okay to feel abandoned, but you can use your words and just tell Julie, I'm so sorry, I felt really abandoned. And you can also tell yourself, she's not abandoning me. She's just in love right now, and she's not herself. She's not thinking clearly. I believe I would have owned that. I believe I would have listened to the house call therapist and said, yeah, you're right. That wasn't okay. And I'm so sorry, Julie. I would have been able to do that. That's what makes me a person who's just a human with BPD features versus an actual borderline personality disordered person who will never admit that they felt the rejection or the perceived abandonment. They will never be able to admit it or take ownership for their behavior. That's a very big difference.
Right. Like they just can't be objective. They can't see the reality of the situation.
I would say they won't.
They won't.
But
they won't. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the difference between having some of those borderline type behaviors and being borderline.
Yeah. Right. So borderline features versus borderline. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a difference. That's a very important difference, because if you won't admit that you're triggered and that it hurts, you know, I, as a therapist, can't work with you because you're not willing to be honest. And if you're not willing to be authentic with me and with yourself, there's not a lot of hope.
Right. Can't make any progress.
Can't make any progress. There's no hope. So let's talk about more about responsible to versus responsible for others' feelings. So if I can learn to say, Katie, I felt hurt when you told me you hung out with Bridget last weekend and you didn't invite me. If I can say that, if I can use my words and be honest with Katie directly and vulnerably, because that does take vulnerability to admit that I was hurt. And it's risky because you might be like, I don't care. Right? So that is a risk. That's another vulnerability, is that the risk I'm taking with how you might respond. You
might dismiss it or not acknowledge,
not
validate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's a risky and vulnerable move. But if I'm willing to do that, I am inviting Katie. It's an invitation to be responsible to me, to my feelings. And she can choose that. So it's an invitation where she has choice. However, if I say, you know, Katie, I hope you had a great time with Bridget. I'm demanding she feel responsible not to my feelings, but for my feelings.
Manipulating.
It's manipulative. Mm-hmm. That's right. It is manipulative. So this time I am not choosing to be direct and I am not choosing to be vulnerable, but I'm using insinuation to imply what I'm feeling and expecting her to read between the lines. And this is manipulative and it's not what grownups do.
No.
Yeah. But again, we're all trying to be grownups all the time, including myself. So I just want to clarify those things. Okay, now for the fun part. I'm excited for this because Katie identifies as a codependent, and we've talked a lot about codependence. And I think this leaf, I want you to be fully exposed right now as a codependent.
All right.
So I want to talk – this is a very evocative statement I'm going to say just for fun. But codependents are narcissists too.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you agree?
I think – yeah, I can see that.
Why can you see that?
I can just see the – I don't know that I would have seen it a few months ago, but I can see it now. The potential self-serving nature of being a pleaser.
Ah, self-serving. Mm-hmm. There we go. Yeah. So not narcissist. I'm using that in like a very colloquial way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's ultimately about the codependent. It's really about them. It really all comes back to them. So I want to kind of do a little expose on that. A lot of people like to self-define not as codependent, but rather as helpers. But guys, when you say helper, me as a therapist thinks codependent. Helper, or I'm a peacekeeper. And I'm like, okay, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. They say, I just love helping people. But don't be fooled, because pleasers like this are self-serving. Mm. Helping others is a way of feeling really a certain way about yourself. So the true reason they please often is because they are approval addicts.
That's where they get their supply from.
Their own narcissistic supply. Right. Ooh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh.
That's their identity, which sometimes leans into what we might call like martyrhood.
Sure.
Say. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's more extreme. Yeah.
Are you referencing someone?
I know
you
some
know?
People like that. Not going to name any names.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it can. Yeah. It would look like martyrhood. Mm-hmm. Like, poor me, I'm always helping. Yes. I'm just so exhausted. And that's a way of getting attention seeking, right?
Yes.
So approval seeking, attention seeking. And the thing is, if you're an approval addict, what happens when, let's say you're a nurse and you're always like, you know, feeling so great about doing the best for everyone, but someone just like hates you, which I know a lot of people in the hospital are like, very mentally sick as well as physically. And what happens when you don't get that approval? Like, that's not a good identity. It's not a secure, stable identity.
No.
Yeah. Also, they please because they want to be the favorite, which y'all heard I want to be too. I'm not a codependent so much, but I do want to be the favorite, which is a human trait for all humans.
Everybody wants to be loved.
Everyone wants to be loved. Or they want to avoid rejection.
Yes.
At the base.
That, right.
You relate to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fear of pain, right?
Yeah. And
lack of security.
Yeah. So the true reason they help or please is really for them, not for the other. So that's really what I want to get down to. The worst thing, though, that I experience about people who are codependent, and I haven't felt this with you, Katie, but I feel like a lot of codependents, I don't really know who they really are. I feel like they're not really themselves. And I'm a very raw person. I like wear my heart in my sleeve. And when I'm around people who I feel are codependent, I'm like, who are you?
Right. I feel like I know what you mean. And they sometimes kind of wait to feel you out before they kind of
they don't think you're for real.
Yeah. So they wait to see what they think you want them to say. Right. Mm. Like, oh, who do you want me to be? Who would you accept? Right. So I'll emphasize that part. of who I am.
So for me, I just want them, I want to get to know that person. And I don't feel like I can. And so I'll be like, man, I'm missing out. Like I get kind of bummed when I'm with people like that. Cause I'm like, can you just be you? Like, I really want to get to know you. And can you just share about you and stop asking me so many questions? Cause I do like to talk. I'm not going to lie. Of course I do, but I want to know you too. And so I just want all the codependents who are listening to know that other people are missing out on getting to know them. There are people who really want to get to know the real them, and we're not. And it is a loss, and it is sad. And I also feel like I don't really trust what they say. Like, for example, do they really want to hear all these questions they're asking about me? Do they really want to hear my answers? Or are they just asking question after question because that's what they do? And so I start to kind of like feel like their interest they're showing me is very fake. Mm-hmm. And even their praise of me feels really empty. And so I kind of lose trust in them.
Right. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. They're not being genuine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a bummer.
Yeah.
Because it's true. Not all people are safe people to be authentic with, but some of us are, and we're missing out.
Right. Well, and it's sad for them too, ultimately.
It's
right?
sad for them.
Because they're not really being themselves.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you can't really have satisfying relationships with people if you're not being your real self.
Yes. And you know, okay, most of my clients are extreme codependents or pleasers. And one of the telltale signs is they'll tell me like the first session, I'm just like always really tired. Like I just burn out from being at work really fast, or I just burn out in social situations. And I'm like, you're burning out because you're putting on a mask and trying to be someone you're not. And yeah, it doesn't feel good. You are exhausted. But if you're really, you learn to be your true authentic self, being around other people can be fun. And it makes me sad that they don't get to experience that.
Yeah.
Because they're too busy performing.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I'm missing out on them. They're missing out on me. They're missing out on life.
Right.
And they're exhausted all the time. And there's a lot of unnecessary loss.
Right. And you wonder, like, I feel like it must be a learned behavior, like whether there was a parent that they felt they had to please and perform for and not show their true self to. I'm not sure where exactly it all stems from.
Well, I think it all stems from never really feeling seen and accepted and approved of as their real self with the parent.
Right.
And often, like we've talked about before, you know, the closest they got for attunement for themselves was attuning to the parent and nurturing the parent. And so that's all they know is human relationships. The best they can do is nurturing the other person.
Right. That's like their default.
That's their default. So guys, if you are feeling like you're relating to that, I would encourage you to go back to my podcast episode called Unrooting Codependency. And I walk Katie through an actual like therapist exercise that I do with a lot of my clients to help undo that. And I know, Katie, you said that was pretty powerful for you.
Oh, yeah. It was good.
It was like a release.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. So I want to encourage that because there are ways. I call them now what I did with you, an integration exercise.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. I used to call them inner child exercise, and now I just call them integration exercise. So it's for you and little Katie to integrate together so you can unlearn what you learned as a child, that you always have to, you know, nurture others or
please. Make everything okay.
Yeah.
Make, right.
Yeah.
Secure the ship kind of like all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So unlearning that. How's it been since we've done that? Have you noticed?
It's been good.
Yeah.
It's kind of a slow process. Mm-hmm. When you've done something for so long.
Yeah.
Like how you said, being an idealist for 40 years, you know, when you've been a pleaser for as long as you can remember.
Yeah.
It takes time to unlearn that behavior.
Okay.
And, but I'm doing it. I'm slowly doing it, both with my husband and my kids and family, friends, just slowly like seeking my own, like, what do I want? You know, what's the right thing for me? You know?
Yeah.
And if I feel myself kind of following in my own bad habits, kind of like checking in with myself, like, okay, no, let's back up
and like
go in a different direction, because that path doesn't work.
So about not betraying yourself.
Yeah, not betraying
myself. Because we talked
about
betrayal. Yeah,
ultimately self-betrayal.
No, like more self-betrayal.
My perception of other people's needs first. And sadly, sometimes, I mean, I think enabling others in a way that's not good for them.
Not good for them.
Either. So, yeah.
Okay.
Listening to my own feelings and trying to like put them out instead of like pushing them down. And
So just to kind of review that really quick, our cat, my cat. Oh my God. So our feelings inform us. We can self-attune. What am I feeling right now? Because that's what pleasers don't do. Pleasers know what everyone else is feeling and are trying to manage everyone else's feelings and feel responsible for everyone else's feelings. But self-attunement is the opposite. It's saying, you know what? I am not responsible for other people's feelings, but I am responsible for my feelings. So I'm going to self-attune. What am I feeling right now?
Yeah.
I'm feeling kind of really tired. What? And our feelings tell us what we need. I'm tired right now. What do I need? I need to like go home and watch some good British drama. Right?
Yes.
Or you know what? I'm feeling angry and it's okay to feel that. What do I need right now? I need to say, stop that, please. Mm-hmm. So that's self-attunement. And that is when we stop betraying ourselves. We learn to self-attune and to be responsible for our own feelings.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about what I call false peacemaking versus true peacemaking. So now we're on the subject of pleasers. And pleasers are false peacemakers. And I want to kind of expose that now. So true peacemaking is not avoiding conflict or not participating in conflict. It is not avoiding acknowledgement of conflict and pretending there is no conflict. Those are not peacemaking things to do.
Right.
That's not a peacekeeper or peacemaker. It's not making everyone apologize and work together without acknowledging the depth of the problem and bringing it to a resolution where everyone is owning their contribution to the problem. True peacemaking is creatively working to bring about harmony, real, true harmony between two or more conflicting parties. True peacemakers aren't everyone's favorite person. In fact, they're often quite the opposite. Because acknowledging the truth is not pretty. Being a mirror to someone who's being ugly and giving those people a true reflection of themselves does not make you their favorite person.
No.
And that's what a true peacemaker does. They shine the light on the ugly reality in an effort to bring about accountability and thus resolution to real peace, like what's the word? Ongoing peace, sustainable peace. So this is not an act of diplomacy, but rather an act of ingenuity and creativity that tailor fits each situation. And the peacemaker is willing to be misunderstood or even defamed in order to bring this about. In other words, the peacemaker takes the hit. So I want to give you an example. And this is going to be really fun for my husband to hear this. So my mother-in-law, I've told you guys before, was borderline personality disorder. And I've shared this, that every family get-together, there would always be a point in the gathering where she would do a public humiliation quip about me. Mm-hmm. She would always humiliate me in front of everyone. Usually it just was one time per meeting, per gathering, but it was horrible. It was dreadful. And I dreaded the get together. As much as I look forward to it, I also dreaded it. It was so hard. Steve, my husband, never did a single thing. He never said anything to his mother, who was named Connie. And he never said anything privately to me after. He didn't even say, like, "Hey, Bronwyn, that was really hard to hear. I'm so sorry that she said that." He never acknowledged it. So as you can imagine, he thought he was being a peacemaker by doing nothing, by pretending.
Right.
That's false peacemaking, or false peacekeeping. And as you can also imagine, this not only made me feel hatred at his mother, Connie, but it also made me feel resentment at Steve. But his younger brother, Tim, who is 15 years younger, was able to find a way to be a real peacemaker. And I want to like exemplify this because it was very creative and it worked. So what Tim did is every time she would do her little blurt to humiliate Bronwyn in front of everyone, Tim would say, he would call out his mom's name and go, "Connie, simmer." That's it. That's all he said. And you know what? That's all he needed to say. Yeah. It worked. Yeah. It was hilarious. It made everyone laugh. It might have even made her – I don't think it made her laugh, but it could have.
Yeah.
But it broke the awkward silence, the elephant in the room that everyone just like – usually after her outburst, everyone just be like, it broke that and it made a lot of us laugh. It worked on his mother, Connie, because she would go silent and shamefaced.
Yeah.
And that's all she needed to hear was, "Connie, simmer." So he would kind of play the role of her dad, even though he was her son.
Yeah.
Right? And it didn't overly shame Connie. It was exactly – it was nothing beyond what was necessary. He didn't like – it wasn't gratuitous. It was just exactly what was needed for the situation. And he did not demand that she apologize, because I think he knew implicitly that that would not have been productive or even realistic, which I'm grateful that he didn't demand that. I felt validated. I felt recognized when he did this, and I felt not alone.
Yeah.
And I no longer felt the shame from what she had done or said, but Connie did, because it showed on her face. And that's how it should be. She should be feeling the shame, and I should not be feeling the shame.
Right.
So it really like brought about an accountability and like a reckoning and kind of like a setting the record straight.
Yeah.
In those two words.
That's amazing.
Connie, simmer. It was like so beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Concise, but super powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not cruel. Just like.
Not cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Knock it off.
You don't need to be cruel. You just to bring about accountability.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to share that.
I love that.
So
you never told me that before.
I know.
Yeah.
That's a true peacekeeper.
Yeah. You're right. Very interesting.
And it can be very creative. And guys, it can be funny.
Yeah.
It really can. Okay. So lastly, I want to end with, if you identify with a false peacekeeper or a codependent or a pleaser or any of these things, let's think about unlearning niceness and replacing with goodness.
Yeah.
So making,
I like it.
Let's differentiate between nice and good. Nice is making everyone happy or shielding them from their discomfort.
Right.
Good is allowing people to feel their own feelings and not shielding them from the natural consequences of their actions.
Right. don't betray yourself and don't betray other people.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't betray. Yeah. Don't enable other people in this case, and don't betray yourself. Yeah. So it's living, it's choosing to live in reality.
Yeah.
Right.
Be real and be good.
Stay in reality. Staying in reality is being good.
Yeah.
Being committed to reality.
Yeah.
Good. And then nice results in everyone being happy with you, and your happiness depends on maintaining that perpetually. That's like it's slavery.
It's placating, right?
And it's placating, and it's never ending.
No, it's never ending. It's exhausting.
Yeah. It's exhausting.
There's no rest.
No peace. Right? No rest.
Just papering over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But being good results in some people being unhappy or disappointed with you, but you're still happy with yourself.
Right.
And that's what matters.
That's like the most powerful thing, right? Is like being at peace with yourself and knowing you did the right thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day,
that's what you want, right?
Yeah.
You want to be able to look at yourself and go,
yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, when we're on our deathbed at the end of our life, we're going to have to sit with ourselves, and we're going to have to do our little life review. And at the end of the day, what matters is, were we true to ourselves?
Right.
And let's start now, guys, because life's too short.
Yeah. Time's running out.
Okay. Well, that's us for today. Thanks for listening, guys. Thank you, Katie, for all the contortion. And we'll see you next time.